Appreciate you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jim Davis. I'm a lawyer from Gulfport, Mississippi, and I represent Torrenda Whitmore. Torrenda Whitmore is a lady who was convicted with Eddie Pugh and Baron Borden of two counts of kidnapping from the Southern District of Mississippi. And just a, you know, short statement of the facts, this actual crime started here in New Orleans, where Pugh and Borden assaulted a Mr. McGillis and a Mr. McCoy at Pugh's mother's home, where Pugh and Mrs. Whitmore were living. They assaulted them, and then they actually put them in the back end of an SUV, drove them over to Jackson County, Mississippi, where they went up a road and actually shot Mr. McCoy. Mr. McGillis got free in the SUV and ran into the woods and was actually shot himself by either Pugh or Borden. As I indicate, I represent Torrenda Whitmore. She had nothing to do whatsoever with this crime. She was at the house in New Orleans and was actually dating Eddie Pugh at the time of the crime. And in connection with this particular assault, her story, and she has been steadfast with it, is that she was at the house. She knew there was some type of confrontation going on between McGillis, McCoy, Pugh, and Borden. But her particular involvement was she had nothing to do with it. She had nothing to do with the assault that took place on McCoy and McGillis. She had nothing to do with tying them up and putting them in the back of the vehicle. She had nothing to do with
She certainly witnessed it all.
That's, Your Honor, with respect, Your Honor, no, I disagree. She, at the trial, I went through a lot of pain trying to diagram this particular house. She was in the back part of the house packing to leave. She had had it with Eddie Pugh. She was leaving. Pugh and Borden and these other two individuals were on the back patio. As far as actually seeing something, she does admit that she saw Borden standing over, I believe, McGillis at one time. Then she actually picked up some pins that had fallen on the floor in the kitchen. The greatest piece of evidence that the government claims to have against my client, that she actually knew what was going on and was a participant in this particular crime, they kind of fluff up their facts and say that my client saw McCoy and McGillis being loaded into the back of the SUV. Before I get there, I need to point out her story was, I'm at this house, I saw the confrontation. Eddie Pugh comes up to me and says, listen, we've gotten over this, everything's okay, don't worry, everything's fine. We're fixing to go drop this SUV off. We just want you to follow us, pick us up after we drop the SUV off, and bring us back home. She contends she never knew McCoy and McGillis were in the back of the SUV. The point, in fact, that the government, I don't want to say misrepresents, but their contention is that she saw McCoy and McGillis being loaded into the back of the vehicle.
But McGillis says he saw her as he was being dragged to the vehicle. And dragged is a different word from just sort of like we're all just jumping in the SUV together.
Now, let's first talk about that particular statement of Mr. McGillis. He gave two previous statements when he was first arrested.
Okay, but credibility is for the jury. The fact that he may have given inconsistent statements is not going to help you on an appellate court. That's a great jury argument. If there's some evidence, then that's what and the jury could have believed, then we have to give deference to that.
I ask you to go to page 692 of the transcript where I cross-examined Mr. McGillis on that particular point. I asked him, I said, where was Mrs. Whitmore when you were put in the back of that SUV? She was in the house. She wasn't out there on the carport. She did not see McCoy and McGillis being placed in the back of that SUV.
She saw him being dragged to the van.
He contends that he saw her in the kitchen. Now, whether he was getting dragged or exactly what, his contention, his revelation at trial, which he had never said before, is that he saw her in the kitchen. And he also says she was standing down deep in the hallway going back to the back rooms where she was packing her stuff up to leave. And I just take great exception, because I do not believe Mrs. Whitmore knew these two individuals were in the back of that vehicle. In the record excerpts that I prepared under, I think it's label number 4, I actually have a picture of the SUV itself in question. And if you'll look at it, you'll see that it is darkly tinted. You can't see in this vehicle. McGillis admitted that he had got extra dark tint on the back end of this SUV. You couldn't see. Because, of course, the court may be wondering, if she followed him all the way from New Orleans to Jackson County, why didn't she see what was going on in the back of that SUV? I ask you to look at that in the record excerpts.
Who supports her version of the story other than her, and she didn't testify? I mean, in other words, her version is, Pew just said, well, we need to go drop off the SUV, so you're not a getaway car, you're just a helpful car, like when you go to take your car to the dealership and your husband takes you. Okay. But that's her version, and she didn't testify, which was her right, but where did that version come in as an affirmative fact? I know the agent talked about her statement.
Correct.
Okay, but that's an admission of a party opponent. That can be used against her. I don't know how it can be used for her.
Because when Officer Lorraine testified, when I cross-examined him, I asked him, didn't she tell you that she thought they were just going to drop off the vehicle? I asked him questions to that effect in my cross-examination, Officer Lorraine, and I tried to develop as much as I could at that time. Not only dropping off the vehicle, I also pointed out with Officer Lorraine in my cross-examination, I said, and didn't she tell you she never saw McCoy and McGillis in the back of that vehicle? And he said, yes. And then I went on to the tinting aspect of the vehicle. So that was a hard decision over whether she should testify or not. But at the same time, in this particular case, the proof was so weak.
I thought there was a witness who saw her car following the SUV and circling around.
Correct. I'll touch on that. Because Mrs. Whitmore admits that when the confrontation started taking place in the SUV, when she pulled up down this dirt road, not dirt road, it's an asphalt road, this abandoned road in Jackson County, all of a sudden the back end of the SUV flips up and Borden and McGillis come rolling out of the back end of the SUV, and it's kind of like, what's going on here? At the same time, Elliot Jones, who was a witness at trial, he's a young man that lives out in this area. He's driving down the road, and he all of a sudden sees three black males standing outside an SUV, one of them running into the woods with one of the other black males shooting at the one running into the woods, and unfortunately, Ms. Whitmore is in a car behind them, but she pulls out and bolts. She leaves. And her story was she was scared. She had never seen any guns or anything until that particular point in time when they rolled out of the SUV. That's when she first saw guns going.
Okay, then why lie to the police? Why not say, oh, man, I'm glad y'all showed up because I just saw the most horrendous thing?
Because I'll tell you why. She had just witnessed what Eddie Pugh and Bam Borden could do. And you think she's going to sit here and say, hey, guys, Bam Borden and Eddie Pugh are hiding over here in the woods right now. Let me snitch on them. Anybody in their right mind is going to say, I've seen what those guys can do. They're bad news. You think I'm going to snitch on them? I wouldn't. And I think anybody in their right mind would say, let me tell you one thing. I got lost. I'm headed to Atlanta, Montgomery. I don't know. I'll admit her story was bad. It was weak. I'm on the way to Montgomery, Atlanta or something, and I got lost. And since I got lost, can you just get me back to I-10? Because she's got one thing on her mind. Get me to I-10, you're never going to see me again. Then that would be on my mind, too. But I think it's reasonable to conclude that she wasn't going to snitch on Pugh and Borden at that particular point in time. And, of course, that's another. My major issue, of course, as you can tell, is I don't think this lady's guilty. And this particular court has always held it won't uphold a jury verdict that's based off speculation, conjecture, inference, and innuendo. I mean, there's got to be some hardcore facts to convict this lady. and you look at page 64 of the government's brief, they point out the four major points that they feel like makes this woman guilty. I ask y'all to please read those, because after you do, you're going to sit here and think, all four of those are nothing but inference and innuendo and speculation and conjecture. None of them are hardcore facts that make this woman guilty. The key point that the government likes to argue is, my client saw these guys getting loaded up in the back of the SUV, and she did not. She's adamant she did not. And if you look at page 692 of the transcript, when I cross-examined McGillis, he admitted when he was put in the vehicle in the carport, Miss Whitmore wasn't out there with him. She was in the house.
Your red light is on. You have time for rebuttal. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All righty. Mr. Jupiter? So you're making the same arguments for, oh, not you, Borden and Pugh, or Pugh and Borden. You're representing Pugh, but you're making the same arguments for Mr. Borden.
Well, Your Honor, I wanted to focus on the statements issue on behalf of Mr. Pugh, as I think the issues
of... Well, that's fine, yeah.
And the statements, as well as the subsequent items that were received as a result or obtained through discovery by the investigators on the third time that they had contact with Mr. Pugh several days after he was in state custody. And we submit that the federal agents in this case dominated this investigation to the point where they had a duty to timely bring him or make sure he was presented before a neutral magistrate.
That's the question that I had here. What evidence is there in this record of the alliance between federal agents and the state agents such that the federal rules should apply?
I think there are a number of things. First of all, the agents were very clear in terms of what they said to Mr. Pugh on the day of his arrest, where they spent several hours with him that initial day. The federal agents. There were actually state agents that were federally deputized, and they testified at the suppression hearing that they spent all of their time under the supervision of the FBI. So they are.
But he was arrested by the state originally.
He is arrested by state agents, but there's a very clear distinction between Agents Miller and Ryan LeMaire, who questioned him for several hours on the first day of his arrest, who are the ones communicating to him what his options are going to be. I think all of these different legal issues that go to the suppression are interconnected with regard to the voluntariness, with regard to whether or not there was initial waiver, with regard to whether or not there was an invocation by Mr. Pugh under those circumstances, and whether or not the second interview was obtained through a psychological persuasion that was the result of official overreaching in this case. So that Mr. Pugh, it was effectively communicated to Mr. Pugh that he had to communicate something with these agents in order to avoid the death penalty, which is the ultimate psychological coercion that someone can receive if they're trying to save their life. Now, so what happened? He was arrested, certainly, by state officers. They're the ones who responded to the scene. But hours after that, all of his contact, all of the statements, several hours of statements, as well as the investigation that takes place, I believe, 6 or 7 days later, where he goes out to the scene with them, is all directed by federal agents. And you see throughout this time that they are letting him know that they're the ones that he can get things done through. The initial thing he comes up with, and you see it throughout the record with regard to his medication, can I get my medication at particular time. FBI agent Lorraine, who initially said this issue of medication never came up till 2 days later, admits on the stand at the suppression hearing that he talked to Agent Miller. Agent Miller communicated in front of Mr. Pugh that he needed him to bring his medication over. Then from the very outset, Agent Miller is put in the conversation before Mr. Pugh made any statement about what his rights were. Agent Miller himself tells him, you're not going to be able to get a lawyer unless you're able to hire one yourself, knowing in fact that very few people can hire a lawyer while they're in state custody in isolation unless they have a whole lot of money. And when Ms. Pugh asks him, well, how does that go? He says, well, you're not charged with anything yet. Now, how is that connected to the other issues? Well, where are you? The very next thing that comes up before Ms. Pugh makes any statement is they're getting him to focus on where are you going to be charged. And you want to be charged in federal court. You know why? Because if you're charged in state court, you're going to be facing the death penalty. This, to me, is, we submit that that is exactly where they wanted him to focus on. And by the time agent, they really didn't get much of a statement from him that first day that they talked to him. The statement really came when Agent Lorraine came and talked to him and added in the further pressures of appeals to his religious beliefs. But, and also continue along this trend of how are you going to avoid the death penalty. And all the while, they knew he was going to be charged in federal court. They made no attempt to bring him into federal custody before a magistrate judge. And we submit the government never established when, in fact, he was in federal custody to see whether or not he met the six-hour rule as enunciated in Corley versus United States. I see my time is up.
All right, sir. Thank you. Mr. Cleveland.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. Gaines Cleveland with the Gulfport U.S. Attorney's Office. I'd like to first deal with a few of the issues that Mr. Jupiter raised with respect to suppression and then turn to some of the questions that Mr. Davis raised with respect to Ms. Whitmore. The trial court fully considered and rejected the defendant's suppression claims in the pretrial order based on the suppression evidence and again properly rejected the suppression claims in its post-trial ruling. On the question of right to counsel, there's no dispute that Pugh was aware he had a right not to speak. The only question was when he would be eligible for appointed counsel. One of the task force agents in the first interview said it was only when he was charged, which is the procedure under state law. The other agent emphasized that he had a right to appointed counsel consistent with the written Miranda form that the defendant signed. But the important point is that Pugh knew he could refuse to speak, even if he had to wait for counsel. And of course, he had been through this process before, as the district court pointed out.
Have you looked at this U.S. Supreme Court case of Burgius, 08-1470, that just came out on June 1?
Yes.
Does this have any bearing on our case?
Only with respect to the issue that Mr. Pugh raises as to injection of religion into a discussion with a defendant. And apparently the court was not disturbed by what was referred to in the opinion as sort of a religious appeal, a discussion with the defendant, if you believe in God, as X, Y, and Z. The difference with as far as the right to counsel is the defendant in that case did not sign the waiver form, the Miranda waiver form, whereas Mr. Pugh signed the waiver form on both the first and the second occasion when the
agent. But, I mean, doesn't Burgius hold you have to have an unequivocal invocation of the right to remain silent?
That's exactly right.
I mean, isn't that helpful to you?
That is another issue that is in this case, and that was not any new law. It certainly strengthens the proposition that you have to affirmatively invoke the right to counsel. There was not any dispute here about that this defendant could refuse to speak. And, of course, he was properly advised of his Miranda rights before the second interview. And as the government argued below, there was nothing used from the first interview. He didn't admit any participation in a kidnapping in the first interview, so there's simply nothing used. And, of course, there's no suggestion there was a deliberate strategy so as to taint the second interview. On the question of voluntariness that Mr. Pugh raises, the court heard the testimony at the suppression hearing. There also is unusual in a federal criminal case a set of recordings of the interviews because this is a capital crime both at the federal level and at the state level, and as a matter of precaution, they recorded the interviews. And if the court has any doubts about the conduct of the interview or the voluntariness, the recordings are part of the record, and they'll answer any concern that the FBI coerced Pugh into confessing by any of the various
means. You're saying these are recorded because these were this was a potential death penalty case, but otherwise you don't record them?
I think as a matter of practice, this was an FBI case. As a matter of practice, they do not record interviews, and I don't know who made the decision, but the kidnapping charge, if it results in death, is a capital potential offense. In this is a defendant who was very, very savvy, Mr. Pugh. In discussing the federal interest at one point in the first interview, he asked, well, hypothetically speaking, if this were a drug case, where would this case be now? In the second interview, he asked for a copy of the federal criminal code, wants to look at it. He asks, if FCI Mariana is a level 4 facility, I've been a prosecutor 20 years, I'm not sure what a level 4 facility is, but Pugh apparently does. So there's no basis for saying that his will was in any way overborne, especially this is a situation where there was an eyewitness, a victim, who told what happened, and so any concerns with respect to the confession of Pugh did not cannot be seriously regarded as having affected the trial result. And there was no basis for a speedy presentment right until there was a federal charge. The case law is very clear on this. This is a situation where the FBI was invited to assist in the investigation until the case was accepted for federal.
Wait, I back up a little bit.
Yes.
This was not a joint task force?
The arrest was initially made, and the defendants were held in custody throughout the initial stage by state authorities. It was a state case.
Yeah, but it's not uncommon to have these joint task forces where the state people do the arresting happily with the feds, and then it sort of drifts along and things are sort of amorphous, and then sort of at the end suddenly the feds say, okay, he's ours, because the state doesn't want to go to the expense of trying him.
Well, this was it's clear from the testimony there was a call to the FBI office in Pascagoula. And there is a task force with state officials, state agents at that task force, and they participated in the case. Now, there were, I think, a total of 5 different crime scenes. Of those 5, only one was investigated by the federal agents. The rest was handled by the state authorities. And there was a state case that proceeded and is still proceeding.
I wondered what has happened on the state case.
Mr. Davis may be able to address it more closely than I can, but I understand that they were indicted for capital murder. The case is set for trial. I believe there are plea discussions which are going on, but it is an ongoing state case. So this is not a situation where the federal agents are using the state as some kind of a stalking horse. It was routine cooperation as described by Judge Dex. The court, the panelists, obviously familiar with the references to the records with respect to Ms. Whitmore's involvement.
And I wanted to ask, I thought that it was the dining room where she was when he was being dragged. Am I misremembering that? It's okay. I can look at it later. But whether it was the dining room or the kitchen,
to me,
didn't McGillis testify that he saw her while he was being dragged?
He saw her
wherever she was
being dragged. And I know Mr. Davis refers to page 612. I don't have that, but page 610 of the transcript definitely includes a reference to the dragging. And we've got that, as you have seen, cited throughout our brief.
Okay, because so is that the testimony that distinguishes this between her just helping them, sort of like when you take somebody to the car dealership to get their car repaired and pick them up? Is it the dragging testimony?
It's a circumstantial case in a lot of ways, except for the victim witness who testified. And we also have Pugh who testified. But he testified she's there. They live together. We know from another part of the transcript that they found $15,000 stuffed into a sofa. I mean, this is a boyfriend and girlfriend. They live together.
Yeah, but just because somebody's your boyfriend doesn't mean you're accountable if he goes off and starts shooting people.
Well, I understand that. her involvement is she was there. She agreed to follow them. It's obvious that there's been a beating at the home, and I think pointed out in your questioning that you know, this is a jury credibility.
Yeah, but I'm trying to hone in on Mr. Davis is saying her story is they were just going to go drop off the SUV and they needed her to take them back. What evidence disputes, because that would explain the following, the stopping at the gas station, all of that. What evidence refutes that? That's my question.
I don't think there's anything that supports it, for one thing. And the fact, I do think the fact that she tells a big whopper at the end, then continues to maintain this lie that she was just happened to be in the area for driving through, when she denies knowing the two people who were involved whose car she was. They were not in a car of anybody that she knew, but she denied knowing them and denied having anything to do with it. I know with respect to sentencing, there's a lot of information that was available to the sentencing judge, and the jury needs to be convinced of the kidnapping. Now, as far as the sentence is concerned, the court had a lot of information to rely on that's in the pre-sentence report.
Okay, and I don't want to belabor this, but I just want to be clear.
Yes.
You're saying what distinguishes this from the innocent, I'm just driving a car because they're going to have to drop one off and come back, is the dragging and the lying to the police about why she was around?
Right, and she acknowledges that she's aware of the situation of that's going on at the house. She says this is effed up. She's aware that this is going on. That's in the trial record. Of course, I don't want to mix up what happened at trial and what happened at sentencing. Let's see. They of course stop on the road at some point to pick up. Here we go. There's pleading that's going on at the house that she is aware of. This is at pages 723 and 846 of the court reporter's transcript. Whitmore sees McGillis lying on the patio at the house in New Orleans and hears him pleading, and that's where the remark that I just referenced follows. That's at page 691 of the transcript, and she's present, of course, at the house when both of these fellows are being dragged to the Sequoia, or they're both dragging McGillis to the Sequoia. That's court report transcript 620, 690, and 695. And then Whitmore is asked to follow this car that Borden has driven to the location. So she knows that there's been this altercation. She's seen them drag the bodies out. She's asked to follow the car. It seems pretty self-evident what the situation is, and we don't have anything contrary to suggest that this was just some sort of an innocent excuse. And of course, when she's later confronted about it, she says, "Well, I'm lost. I don't know anything about these guys."
What does the record reflect caused this event?
It is mysterious.
It's
very mysterious, and I don't think that you'll find a satisfactory answer in the trial transcript. And I'm not even sure what's in the sentencing will help the court that much, but what's in the pre-sentence report is that apparently Pugh did disclose to Whitmore that she had a suspicion that McGillis was there working for the police in some sort of a setup, or was trying to set him up to rob and kill him. But that still is not, I mean, it's not clear cut at all. That's at paragraph 20 of the pre-sentence report.
Well, there's something about thinking McCoy was a police officer.
That's exactly right. And they had this...
It doesn't help them on the Capitol case that they thought they were killing a police officer. They just didn't.
McGillis had been by the house earlier that day and then left, so there was an opportunity for some discussion between Pugh and Whitmore as to what was going on. So we all told do believe that the trial court rulings were correct on the suppression evidentiary rulings, and that the court, there was certainly satisfactory evidence from the standpoint of giving the benefit of the doubt to the jury under the evidence, and we think that the sentencing is
why was the 9/11 call admissible?
Well, it's own standpoint, it's sort of an odd thing to call a 9/11 call, because it was really somebody came up to a fire station, and the fireman related what was going on to the police. It had the sort of contemporaneousness that you have with the usual 911 calls. But our take on that ultimately is it just makes no difference. It basically helped establish how people got to where they were and where the sequoia was found, but didn't add anything to the trial.
All right, Mr. Cleveland, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Davis, yes, I know. Thanks.
I do want to point out that I agree with something that Mr. Cleveland said. He said Eddie Pugh was very savvy. I'll agree with that. He's very savvy. He's very charming. He has a fairly lengthy criminal history, as opposed to Torrendra Whitmore, who is not savvy, who has no – this was the first time she had ever been arrested in her entire life. And so she was stupid for trusting Eddie Pugh. Eddie Pugh said, we're going to go drop this car off and follow us, and then we'll get back home, and she does it.
What was the theory about we're going to drop this car off? I mean, Judge Haynes talks about that's a circumstance we're all familiar with. We drop it off at the dealership and so on. Where in Jackson County, what was the point of this?
I'll admit some lights should have flashed off, and your regular person, it would have. But that's why I point out again who I'm dealing with, Torrendra Whitmore, who's never been in the criminal justice system. She's not aware of street smart Eddie Pugh and Bam Borden. And she's a little bit more gullible. So she would sit there and say, okay, this is my boyfriend, and, you know, he's saying, let's go follow, I'll just blindly do this. And I admit, you know, no doubt with her, it's the dumbest thing she's ever done in her entire life. But, again, I ask you to look at, you know, page 692, where I actually confronted McGillis, and I said, okay, was she outside when you were being loaded into that sequoia in the back seat? No. She's inside. He sees her in the kitchen. And as I painfully tried to do diagrams, because quite frankly, I was caught totally by surprise at trial when he has this revelation that he sees my client in the kitchen while he's been taken to the vehicle. So I attempted to make diagrams of the house to show that where he said she was standing, which was back in the hallway connected to the kitchen, there's no way she could see in the carport, him and McCoy being loaded into the sequoia.
But, I mean, isn't there a difference between seeing him being dragged and seeing him being loaded? I drag somebody for a while, and then I pick him up and put him in the SUV. She could have seen the dragging without seeing the loading and still know enough to know something's up, and this isn't just dropping something off at the dealership.
At the same time, I don't think she saw them putting them into the vehicle. I think you're putting that one more step and getting them into the vehicle. She saw her, based off McGillis' story, which she adamantly denies, she saw something going on in the kitchen, no doubt. And in McGillis' words, what does she say? I don't know if you caught that. In McGillis' words, she says, this is effed up.
Oh, I caught that.
Yeah, and she said,
it's
you know,
quoted several times.
And I'm wondering why that's enough to find somebody responsible for kidnapping,
okay,
when they
now
give their assessment.
They're in McGillis's SUV. She sees him get attacked. She sees him get dragged. They're in McGillis's SUV, and she's just helping them drop it off. I mean, what does she think happened to McGillis? I don't know that every little jot and tittle has to be proved. You can make reasonable inferences from the evidence as long as that is sufficient to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
And it's the line between reasonable inferences and nothing but innuendos and nothing but speculation and conjecture. My contention is that is all this is speculation and conjecture. There's nothing concrete.
What is another explanation for those events? In other words, she sees him being dragged. She sees him effed up. and all of that. She sees him having been assaulted. They get in his SUV, McGillis's SUV. Now, what is the innocent explanation for all that?
As savvy, charming Eddie Pugh told her, honey, we're just taking this car over here to deliver it. And they actually pointed out to me how savvy, and I'll add the word charming and polite and charismatic, Eddie Pugh is. You have his statement. You can look at his statement. He is. He's very smooth. Tarinda Whitmore is very dumb. She's very gullible. And she just bought her boyfriend's story that we're going to go drop this car off. And just want to point out one thing. The government cites to two cases in their brief to support their argument, a Gully and a Willis. Of course, Gully, the defendant, had blood on his hands. They actually had him on video chasing the victim, and he actually told a witness that we're going to kill this guy. And then in U.S. versus Willis, that was a bank robbery wherein the co-defendants took the stand and said this guy was the mastermind behind the entire bank robbery. He's clearly responsible. So we point out their cases are, they don't support them whatsoever in these facts. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. We understand, Mr. Davis, you're court-appointed, and we appreciate your service. I assume you're court-appointed, too, Mr. Coates? Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for preparing the brief on behalf of your client. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.